Welcome to the audio podcast of The Table,
a new United Methodist community of faith taking shape at Central UMC in Sacramento, California.
The podcasts currently feature the messages of Matt Smith and Linda Duhirsu,
with a musical introduction by Anthony Coleman, our director of music.
Thanks for listening.
Revising the roles, deciding the share. With wisdom and grace, dividing the power. For woman and man, a system that's fair. And God will delight when we are creators of justice and joy. And joy.
The Psalms are a collection of stories, a collection of songs, a collection of poems that were handed down from generation to generation to help people root their lives in grace. And so the ancient Israelites and Jesus would have sung what we call the Psalms now as a way to shape themselves in the past, as a way to shape themselves in who God is and who they are in relationship to God. And so we're going to draw on the Psalms all summer and this morning as we think about just those questions. How has faith been handed to us and how is it being expressed out around us? And so I'm going to move into Psalm 25, which I hope is going to connect with where we're heading in this moment. But I want to pause with an introduction to it for a moment. It's called an alphabetic acrostic. So what that means is, for the non-English majors among us, myself included, it means that each letter of the alphabet is going to start the next line. And so as you go down and you read Psalm 25, it's starting with A and then B and then C all the way down. And that's what Psalm 25 is. And it's also kind of seen as a model prayer. It's intended to be shared over and over to help folks practice their faith. And so it'll appear up here, and I want to invite you to hear these words. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. O my God, in you I trust. Do not let me be put to shame. Do not let my enemies exult over me. Do not let those who wait for you be put to shame. Let them be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, for you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all day long. Be mindful of your mercy, O Lord, and of your steadfast love, for they have been from of old. Do not remember the sins of my youth or of my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for your goodness' sake, O Lord. Good and upright is the Lord. Therefore, God instructs sinners in the way. God leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble the way. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep God's covenant and decrees. So to lift up your soul to the Lord is, this happens in churches all over the world. Somehow our church that's gotten going over the last few years, we don't often see people in here who lift up their hands. I know it makes some among us uncomfortable if that happens, because that feels like a little bit too much. We're supposed to just stay really calm in the pews. But when people do that, what we're doing is we're saying, I'm turning my life over to God. And so that's the expression that people are making. I lift up my soul to you, Lord. That's where that comes from, because deep inside of our bones, we want to express that life is not all about me. And I'm not going to trust just in myself, but I'm going to listen for God's guidance and teaching and instruction. And that's what this song comes back to over and over and over again. Rabbi Abraham Heschel says it this way. It's not a feeling for the mystery of living or a sense of awe, wonder, or fear which is the root of religion, but rather the question what to do with the feeling for the mystery of living, what to do with the awe, what to do with the wonder, what to do with the fear. And that's what the collection of Psalms do for us. They help guide us and instruct us and teach us about how to live life together, what to do in response to the moments of fear and awe that can overwhelm us and inspire us. The psalmists don't shy away from that. They dive right into it, into the awe and the mystery and even the fear. And they trust that when we lift our souls to God in that way, we can be made new. And so I want to be really clear for a moment. Baseball is not God. Nor is nature that a lot of us think we experience God in. Nor is the beauty of a song, no matter how amazing it is. Nor is the stunning artwork that's around us or an icon. All of those are windows to help us sense where God is and how God is. They're not God, but they're windows that invite us to see the depths of God. And that's how we're looking at baseball this morning, as a window to see how God might be in our lives. And so since we're weaving baseball and this psalm together, it feels really imperative to me that we look at it with some statistical analysis, because baseball people love statistics. That's just like what you do if you're a baseball person. And there's a fight in baseball about, are you going to go by the statistics, or are you going to go with that feeling that's inside of you? Like, are you going to go with the statistics to send that left-handed batter up, or are you going to go with the feeling of, this guy can do it? And so I want to just lift up a couple of errors in Psalm 25 that I found interesting and I wanted to share with you all. So we shared that it's an acrostic poem. The fifth letter in the alphabet, in the Hebrew alphabet, is either and or but or or. But in almost every ancient translation of the psalm that we have, it's totally left off. So if you're trying to teach this to people, it's interesting to me that you make an error as you pass it down from generation to generation over and over again by simply leaving off the letter that you're supposed to be starting with. Makes it a little trickier to remember, actually. And then if you keep going, you get down to the 18th line, and it's supposed to be in our English alphabet. I'm pretty sure that would be an R. But it goes right into the S. And then line 19 is S2. So there are errors woven into Psalm 25 as it's handed down. And there are some among us that when they see those errors, they'll say, well, fine. If it's not all perfect the way it's supposed to be, I'm throwing the whole thing out. For me, though, like with baseball, the errors in the midst of that allow me to see the struggle and the truth of it. The humanity of trying to make sense of how we relate to a text, how we relate to God. But baseball is more than stats, no matter how much you follow them with your fantasy baseball team. Baseball is more than stats. There's that sense of awe and wonder and hope that so many folks experience in particular moments. And so I want to set up one moment from baseball history. And I think it relates to where we are in the world to help us see our neighbor and our enemy as well. Because it's a story about the Oakland A's on the wrong side of the moment. And some of you already know what I'm talking about, from 1988. And some of you have no idea, so I'm going to share just a little bit about it. There's a guy named Kirk Gibson. The A's fans among us still love Kirk Gibson. Kirk Gibson was the player that every manager wanted to coach. He ran like the wind. He hit for power. He was a great fielder in the outfield. But more than that, he had those intangibles. Like, when you were around Kirk Gibson, you just want to step your game up. That's just who he was. It's how he played. He was, as Eleanor would say these days, he was fierce. He was fierce. He was also the most valuable player in 1988. They had just finished. He was playing with the Dodgers at the time. People can boo that as well. I'll boo that internally. He was playing with the Dodgers at the time, and they had just finished a phenomenal series with the Mets. And Kirk Gibson was literally all torn up. His left hamstring, totally done. His right knee, totally out. So he is sitting out game one of the 1988 World Series as the Dodgers are playing against the Oakland A's. The A's are supposed to dominate this series. That's what was anticipated. So, Tommy Lasorda, the manager of the Dodgers, he could not deal with the total absence of his star player, Gibson. So he kept sneaking down between innings to the clubhouse where Gibson was, receiving ice and going through therapy. He kept going down to check, like, are you ready to hit now? And Gibson kept giving him the thumbs down. He's not ready. And then the ninth inning finally rolls around. And the A's are nursing a 4-3 lead, and Dennis Eckersley is on the mound. And so if you know Dennis Eckersley, you know that the game is over. He's the best closer in baseball in 1988. He was a starting pitcher before that, but he had been converted in his own life. He found sobriety, and he went from being a starting pitcher to the most dominant reliever in the game at the moment. So Eck, as they know him, comes into the game.
Also had very great hair.
We track different things in this So Eck is in, and what Kirk Gibson, who's in the clubhouse, realizes is that the pitcher spot is fourth up in the ninth inning. And so he goes and sends a message to Tommy Lasorda, I can hit. And Lasorda finds it within himself to trust not the statistics, but the feeling, the moment of what's happening. And he says, okay. And Gibson comes out of the clubhouse, and he's about to go up into the dugout. And Lasorda makes him stop. Because what Lasorda knows is that if he goes and stands in the on-deck circle, they're going to pitch to his number 8 hitter. They're for sure going to pitch to him because they don't want to fake Kirk Gibson no matter how hurt he is. And so instead, the manager sends up a lowly hitter infielder, reserve infielder named Dave Anderson. And he stands in the on-deck circle, and Eck falls for it. He pitches around the number 8 guy because he's going to throw instead to the reserve infielder that's on deck. And as soon as he walks that 8th batter, he's on base, and Coach Lasorda sends Kirk Gibson to bat. And the stadium erupts. Like, completely goes crazy that this is actually happening. And Kirk Gibson kind of limps out. I always thought for effect, but maybe he was really actually hurt. But he limps out to the batter's box. He limps out to that space. And Eckersley looks just as dominant as he always has. He has 2 strikes on him, and then Gibson fouls a couple off, and it's a 2-2 count. And on the 2-2 count, the guy who was on first steals second. So now all the A's need is a single, and the game's tied. That's all they need, a single, and the game is tied. So Eckersley is getting ready to throw, full count, 3-2. This is it in baseball, right? As he's making that pitch, or getting ready to make that pitch, Gibson calls timeout. And he steps out of the batter's box, and it looks like he's just gathering himself. Like he's hurt, he's trying to suck it up one last time. What he later reveals, and this comes out in Baseball as a Road to God, is that there was a scout whose name was Mel Didier. And Mel Didier is in his 60s, and he lives in Louisiana, but what he had shared with them was, when the game is on the line, Dennis Eckersley is going to throw what you know is called a backdoor, or some know as a backdoor slider. And so what that means is it's going to start to a left-handed batter on the inside part of the plate, and it's going to tail inside, so there's nothing they can do with it. The last thing that you do as a batter in that moment is guess slider, though, because the fastball is going to crush you. So you can't do what this scout says to do, which is look for that inside slider, that backdoor slider. But Gibson, he says later, he stepped out, and when he's hitting his foot with the bat, he's remembering that scouting report. And he's believing He's believing in what that report says. And then he steps back in and Eckersley does exactly what was predicted, what he had expected, and you know what happened. So let's watch.
9-1 at second base. With two out, now the Dodgers don't need the muscle of Gibson as much as a base hit. And on deck is the legal man, Steve Sachs. 3-2.
Perhaps no more iconic moment in baseball World Series history than that one, and no more iconic call than Vin Scully's. In a season that it's been so improbable, the impossible has happened. You see ecstasy for the folks in LA, and you see agony for the folks in Oakland. What if we were to suggest that that's actually a story of faith? See, Gibson could have stayed in the clubhouse. He could have said, it's not about me, it's about somebody else. And Tommy Lasorda could have placed his trust somewhere else. We say, I lift up my soul to you, O Lord. Tommy Lasorda could have placed his trust somewhere else, in a different person. And then Gibson, at that moment, in a 3-2 count, he could have dismissed what that scout had said to him. He could have said, I'm going to trust myself. I'm going to trust only in what I know at this moment, and I'm going to put my hope there. But somehow, he allows himself to fall and to say, I am going to place my trust in this scout that I don't even know, but has told me this is what's going to happen. I don't see this person. He's not here at the moment, but I'm going to place my trust right there with him. That's exactly where Gibson ends up going and what happens. Lasorda puts his trust in Gibson, and Gibson puts his trust in the scout, and the rest is history. Or, for a moment, if you think about it from the other perspective, Dennis Eckersley and the A's, the history of that series could be totally different if this dominant closer hadn't just gone back to what was predictable, to what he knew. He could have tried to live out something more risky. He was known for going back to the backdoor slider over and over and over again. And he did it one too many times. And Oakland went down 2-0 instead of going back to Oakland 1-1. That shaped the story. That shaped the World Series. This one hit, 1988 World Series, may be the most exciting mixture of spirit and mind and matter in the history of the game. So think through for a moment the faith that was embodied in all of the little moments that led up to that one. Gibson had to believe that he could do this, and Lasorda had to try to place his trust in that player. And then he had to stand in the box and place his trust in the scout. The psalmist says, "To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul." The acrostic poem that we shared was shared over and over and over to help people pass faith from one to another. Over and over, those folks chose to lift up their souls to God, placing trust not in themselves or in the powers that be, but in the one that was calling them home. The God of the Psalms longs for people to come home. We struggle, we protest, we doubt, we fear, we cry, and we laugh. And in the Psalms, we meet the full range of emotions. It doesn't shy away from it. Just as baseball expresses a full range of emotions and possibilities, both from the place of ecstasy felt by LA and the place of agony felt by Oakland, we find ourselves at different moments in our life experiencing both of those. And the Psalms meet us right there where we are. And they say that God is making us new, that God is inviting us home, that God has reached inside God's own heart and pulled out a form that people might understand in this holy human being named Jesus and placed it here on earth, that we might find new ways to be together in community. And it's a God that doesn't say that we should stand in the way that happened a year and a half ago in Florida, but it's a God that says we're called to figure out how to live life together. But this isn't just my home, it's our home. And it's not a place that I'm supposed to protect with all that I am. It's a space that I'm supposed to be open and vulnerable and learn from people that don't look like me or sound like me or feel like me or move in the ways that I move, whether they're for the A's or they're for the Dodgers, whether they're white or they're black. This is a God who longs for us to break free from those places and to find ways of being home together. That's what the psalmist wants. That's what the psalmist cries out for, is can we break free from what's held us back and see people as the child of God that they are? As we create home like that in our neighborhoods, can it be safe? Not just for me, but for all of us. When we lift up our souls, are we going to lift it up in the ways that tighten who we are and how we are, or are they going to invite us to see that Christ is in us and among us all around, in every child of God, every child of God? And so I want to close with a piece about safety and home. And I think George Carlin says it best. So I'm going to let him say it.
In football, the object is for the quarterback, otherwise known as the field general, to be on target with his aerial assault, riddling the defense by hitting his receivers with deadly accuracy, in spite of the blitz, even if he has to use the shotgun. With short bullet passes and long bombs, he marches his troops into enemy territory, balancing this aerial assault with a sustained ground attack which punches holes in the forward wall of the enemy's defensive line. In baseball, the object is to go home and to be safe. I hope I'll be safe at home. Safe at home.
And we can laugh about it, and I think we need those moments of levity. And there's also a deep truth that baseball is about going home and being safe at home. And yet we live in a culture, myself included, that I'm excited about the Kansas City Chiefs, and we glorify the violence of football in those ways. And yet baseball calls us back to be safe at home in this timeless sport that slows us down and calls us to notice how grace is unfolding around us. And the psalmist calls us to lift up our souls to God, a God that wants to call us home and be safe. Not just you, not just me, but every child of God in every street corner, whether they have on a hoodie or they have on a t-shirt. That God wants us to see each other as beloved children. and that God wants us to root our lives in that kind of grace, and that God longs for us to grow in faith and to hold that. And so may the games that we play not just be daily ones or doubleheaders, but may the game of coming home and being safe be the work of our lives in every single moment, in every single time, with every child that we encounter or every person that we fear, and we find new ways of seeing ourselves and seeing God in one another. And may we then come home and be safe. Amen.
Come and find the quiet center in the crowded life we lead. Find the room for hope to enter. Find the frame where we are freed. Clear the chaos and the clutter. Clear our eyes that we can see. And simply be.